everyone. We're excited to be here with you today for ISOCA Live. We are closing out Cybersecurity Month with a look at part two of our State of Cybersecurity Research. But before we begin, be sure to share in the comments with us where you're joining from today. I'm Kristen Kessinger. I'm Director of Communications at ISOCA. And our cybersecurity expert with us today is John Brandt, who is our Information Security Lead. John leads ISOCA's State of Cybersecurity Research Study, and he will be here with us today to talk about what this year's findings mean for you and for your organization. If you missed part one of our survey, be sure to go back to our LinkedIn page after this one and catch it there. And now we'll get started with part two. So hi, John.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for having me again.
Sure. I know we talked about workforce on our last call. Can you start with an overview of what part two of our research covers and what we'll be talking about today?
Oh, absolutely. So part two report is more typically always an operational aspect of it. So over the last couple of years, it's kind of grown. We've kind of made some, just kind of tailored it, right, with some of the things that have been going on. This year's report, you know, like the last couple of years, addresses the threat landscape. For the second year in a row, we kind of delve into security operations, really trying to tease out the overlap between IT and SecOps. New for this year is actually we incorporated some cyber maturity stuff.
Great. And we will definitely get to that. For the next question, though, what were the most frequent types of cyber attacks reported this year? And did you find any surprises this year compared to past years?
So, you know, across the entire report, just like with part one, a lot of the data remain kind of consistent. So top three issues again this year, social engineering, APT, and ransomware were the top three responses regarding reported cyber attacks. Surprising? No. I think if anything, just keeping in mind for our readers, right, that the 2021 report is actually based on 2020 data. So recognizing that, right, we were still kind of, while the data collected was potentially very far along in the pandemic, some of that stuff takes a time to catch up. And when we talk about dwell time, right, which is the time from an attack happens to the time that an attack is actually detected, those things can actually influence how our respondents are reporting. So the one takeaway, though, is we had in previous years seen a stepped decrease in cyber attacks year over year. And this year, actually not surprisingly, it actually rebounded to levels that we hadn't seen in a few years.
Why do you think that might be?
Well, listen, bad actors are opportunistic, right? So, you know, interestingly enough, there was a question in this year's report where we asked, bad actors, did they take advantage of COVID-19 to disrupt business operations? And I believe the response was like 43% said no. What's interesting there, though, is that how we word the question matters. And like I think we talked about on our part one report, and I've talked about on other media outlets, is there's always a little bit of subjectivity on any survey. So how the questions is written, how it's interpreted. So that kind of, I think, largely influenced how that specific question was asked. We largely know in most media reports cover this as bad actors, regardless of whether they're in cybersecurity or just your everyday average criminal out there, is going to take advantage of circumstances that are abnormal. So whether it's weather related, it's a pandemic, you know, this health, big health thing, anything out of the ordinary where people are kind of preoccupied on other things. So I really wasn't surprised to see the uptick. So we're wrapping up the 2021 report here in Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we're already planning, right? So the next year survey, you know, is going to get released next month. So I am very much, I'm very eager to see how year two of the pandemic influences and kind of builds upon what we've seen and see if there's any consistent themes and how that actually compares and contrasts with other people are reporting.
Yes, that will be interesting. For this year, we know it's been a big year for ransomware. Are there any steps that you think companies need to take now that may be often overlooked?
Boy, can I, you know, big bold letters, yes, you know, flashing lights and everything. Absolutely. A lot of this boils down to cyber hygiene. So, the assumption is, you know, we have a lot, we've got a lot of passionate members. And I think a lot of our members and the companies they work for are largely doing things right. However, it takes a village. And I, you know, likewise, we have a lot of volunteers, you know, in the thought leadership we puts out is hopefully empowering, you know, tomorrow's members and the consultants out there that are continuing to earn the trust of companies. When we talk about ransomware, right, it's largely a business continuity issue. And a couple, you know, just the simple things. First and foremost, backups, right? Backups, backups, backups. And it's not enough to just say, hey, I'm backing up in the cloud, because that's just one avenue, right? And for my military days, and specifically, you know, the special warfare community that I worked in for a bunch of years, you know, there was a saying that two is one is none. And so you always have to plan for the backup getting messed up, right? And whatever that is, whatever your fail safe is in life. If you think you're going to go on this road trip and you're going to go this route, okay, well, what happens if something happens along that route? You have an alternate path, an idea. Ideally a tertiary. And when we talk about, you know, backups in general, you know, this is no different. So this is not, you know, this LinkedIn Live is not meant to be a how-to session on IT operations 101. It's really meant to sound the alarm, so to speak, to A, make sure that companies have backup strategies, make sure that they're varied, make sure that they take into consideration that geographic considerations become pretty important. There's a lot of lessons learned over the last decade that I could point to with different reports where a company, let's say in the mid-Atlantic region here of the United States, here in Baltimore, Maryland area. So if you're a company here and you're doing, you know, and you're doing some offline backups or local, you know, it doesn't make sense to put all your eggs in one basket and have something just down the road 30 minutes from now, because as we know, like weather-related events, it's going to take out a large diameter of where you're at. So you have to take that in consideration and make sure geographically, you know, you're kind of minimizing it. Does that option then take longer to potentially restore? Sure, because then you have to factor in how you know, either having to get to that site or having to have a backup site, you know, a cold or a warm site. How long does it take for those things to come online? The other thing, encryption, encrypting the data. You know, the tagline that we're increasingly hearing out there, and I'm a huge fan of it, so I've kind of taken it as my own as well, is, you know, cybersecurity is about making the cost of cyber attacks more expensive for the bad guys or gals. The bottom line is security is a state of mind. There is no such thing as 100% security. We cannot protect against everything, everywhere, every moment of the day. It just it's not going to happen. We don't know what we don't know. So a piece of software or hardware that does not have a known vulnerability today does not mean that, you know, tomorrow, day after, whatnot, it doesn't, right? And, you know, software patches, sometimes that's introduced. Sometimes there's just things that aren't known. And there's a lot of passionate people out there, both on the good and the bad side of things, trying to discover these things. And that's why those remediations and like bug bounties and things like that become really important. The last thing is security awareness. And I would expand that to security education and awareness training, because security awareness by itself has a very limited scope, very fixed connotation, right? And it's not about awareness. And I use the example of, you know, the awareness piece for a company regarding, like, we'll talk since the question about ransomware is, the awareness going out aspect of it is you sending out a corporate email that says, we're seeing phishing attacks from this entity to hear or whatnot. That's the awareness. The awareness, though, it has not instructed your company, all the employees who are, we largely consider them first line of defense, what to do. So that's where the training piece comes in, right? Or the education. So it you need to be a little bit more robust with it. The days of just sending out an email and it is not may not be enough anymore. You may need to be a little bit more prescriptive with what you want your end users to do. So those three things, backups, encryption, and the security education awareness training, I think what we'd call low-hanging fruit and things that could get done to make it harder for you to lose data should the unthinkable happen.
One positive finding with the survey was that we found that respondents say that their satisfaction with the effectiveness of security awareness is increasing. Why do you think that might be this year?
Well, I think that it's somewhat tied to the discovery, right? Is I think that if the awareness training is working, you're going to kind of see this in one of two aspects. One is perhaps you're being notified more from your end users of things that they're seeing. So if you think about some of the options that have kind of been built, baked into different things, and we'll use like the various plugins into Office Suite or whatnot, where you can kind of report phishing or whatnot. If you're seeing an uptick in that on the heels of doing some education and training of that, that's all good stuff. The other thing is, that I would caution is that correlation and causation are very different things. So again, it is through the eyes of the survey respondent, into which we cannot control that. But if they see that they've increased their frequency of training, or maybe stood up a program and cybersecurity incidents, right, in their help desk or however they're tracking that, are going down, there could be an inclination for them to kind of connect it to. It doesn't mean that one is causing a decrease in the other. It could be, but it may not be. And that really kind of ties into a later question, the cyber maturity, or more importantly, a comprehensive program where you have really your pulse on the cyber, your information security program across the company.
Well, that is a perfect segue to my next question. Cyber maturity was another big topic of the survey. Can you just give us a quick definition of what that really means and what the survey revealed about it?
Sure. So there's a business definition for cyber maturity, right? And it really kind of boils down to, like anything else, not a whole lot of agreement on different things, but really is the repeatable processes, right? And there's different ways of measuring maturity or whatnot. CMMI is just one aspect of it. There's different criteria out there. Generally speaking, what we're, when we're talking about cyber maturity is really, what is your level of awareness and impulsivity, if you will, right? The oversight, how are you basically driving the program, or is the program driving you? Because if we think about this, somebody that is just started a cybersecurity program, kind of hard to imagine unless you're a brand new company, right? Because this is not new. But if you're just starting out, right, and don't have anything, you'd really be at the bottom of the list there. And you're really just kind of, it becomes a firefighting routine, right? And a lot of cybersecurity professionals, a lot of our life, unfortunately, becomes firefighting anyway, right? It's always, you're just in a response mode. Whereas if you're on the other side of things and you really are, you're doing the regular things, you've got kind of what I would call a battle rhythm, right? Is you know that you're doing your risk assessments this way, you know that you've got good policies, you know you have a good corporate cybersecurity culture, executive buy-in, all these things. And it becomes really good. I just see that, somebody just put a comment in there, starts his vulnerability awareness. Absolutely, right? At the end of the day, where we want everybody to be is to raise the sea of knowledge across the board. And as we're seeing right now with global supply chain issues, it is the smaller companies to which there are a lot of them are ultimately you're supporting larger ones. So with that kind of behind us, what did the survey results tell us? And this was the first year that we asked some of these questions, and some of them we're going to continue forward, because I love the trending aspect of that, right? To kind of keep a pulse on things. Respondents, 65% of respondents say that their organizations are measuring cyber maturity. That's a good thing. Does it mean that they're measuring the right things? Not necessarily, but they're measuring in some capacity. And this is to no fault of their own, right? The industry is still struggling with on the metric side of things. And these things are obviously, they're complicated by the types of maybe your reliance on vendor tools, outsourcing, and stuff like that. The interesting thing about that, though, is those that do measure cyber maturity were two times more confident to detect and respond to cyber incidents. And that really speaks to having your pulse on the program there and actually having those good, sound business relationships with the business leaders and whatnot, and really the trust, because at the end of the day, your cybersecurity is a business enabler, and long gone should be the days of us being viewed as an impediment. Yeah, there's a lot of times that, you know, sometimes that we're highlighting the risk, but at the end of the day, it's to work with them, understand their business needs, be able to explain to them the risks, because at the end of the day, cybersecurity is about technical risk, of continue to do certain things certain ways, and then empowering them to make decisions, right? Because ultimately it should be the business leaders for a particular function, depending on the size and scope, that are ultimately own those decisions. And that may not be the way it is in practice in certain places, but pie in the sky, optimist world, that's the way it should work.
Absolutely. I have one last question for you before we get to an audience question, and that is, what was a finding from this year's survey that gave you the biggest reaction? That might be positive, it might be negative, but yeah, what stood out to you?
Yeah, you know, as I combed the report in preparation for today, the thing that it's disappointing is that 39% of respondents are doing annual risk assessments. And I say that, right, because it's just not enough. I'm not here. If you can't do anything but annual assessments, great. At least you're at least doing them. But the reality is that the world and your corporate environment is changing so much more frequently. And as every company is in different stages of their digital transformation, and in any adaptations they made for COVID and remote work and whatnot, going to, whether they pushed everything to the cloud, went a hybrid on-prem cloud model, their usage of service providers comes into play. It's just no longer appropriate. So I understand. Listen, part one report, we talk a lot every year, right, about the shortage in the pipeline, right? The supply demand curve is way out of balance, and there's a lot of there's a lot of good ideas on how we kind of remedy that, but I think at the end of the day, more emphasis needs to be on the risk side of things, because that's going to more. It's going to inform the thing, what you're working on or what needs to change, right? Instead of just chasing the next vendor product that somebody makes you aware of or whatnot, because the business drivers, right? What is those business needs? Why are you doing what you're doing, or why are you continuing to do some of the things you're doing? So from that aspect, that's what's important, is to kind of keep, to keep in the crosshairs of the need to kind of continuously monitor your threat landscape.
Absolutely. We have two audience questions here. From Kyle, are there any standardized security templates that are good to start with?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that, ISOCA does not have anything per se, right? We have a lot of, we tend, a lot of our thought leadership is descriptive in nature. I'll give a, somebody might cringe, on my team, but there are, I know that I think they might be a little dated, but if you're looking for some policy templates and whatnot, you could surely look at, I know SANS has some posted on their website. Your local chapters are great sources. If you're an ISACA member and you're part of a chapter, I'd recommend you go there first. While this is not a concrete statement, my involvement with some of the chapters is often that they tend to be a larger grouping of the same industries and whatnot. So I think that though what you find there might be a little bit more appropriate and require less tailoring.
Absolutely. And then from two different people, we got some questions on what should be a focus for cybersecurity and cybersecurity strategy in 2022. Big question.
Zero trust. I can't push zero trust enough. Everybody, if you read any kind of articles, follow podcasts, webinars, there's a reason why a lot of people are focused on it. It's not new, right? At the end of the day, right? If you know anything about zero trust, it's a sexy rebranding of assume breach mentality. But regardless of how we got here, there's some powerful business cases there for why you want to get there. And I think it kind of helps, if done right, you're forced to really work on the strategy, which is the best, right? Because without a strategy to do anything, you're really kind of it's this fragmented approach. So lots of good articles out there. There's some good thought leaders. All right, you can look at the so-called godfather of zero trust, right? Kindervag was a former forest analyst. A buddy of mine, Dr. Chase Cunningham, right? Dr. Zero Trust. Follow those two, right? If you've not ever heard about zero trust, interested in learning more, follow their stuff out there, their social media presence. A lot of good stuff there, especially those of you that are cloud-based, between extending the perimeter for various reasons, this whole remote workforce and everything, zero trust cannot get enough accolades. I'm seeing a bunch of people there. There you go. What is it really anchored in, though? Least privilege and need to know. And that actually can kind of tie back to your earlier question, Kristen, about steps for ransomware. One of the things that I've routinely heard and I've seen in the course of my corporate travels, right, and beforehand, is that we, especially in the corporate sector, we unnecessarily give people access to more data than what they need to do their job. So that's really, really important to kind of reel that in, because that kind of helps minimize your risk exposure. Yeah, so LinkedIn user here, zero trust does not protect from an insider threat who already has access. Good point. I tell you, we talk about zero trust and everything, right? And an insider threat becomes pretty darn important. And ISACA did release a white paper, I believe probably 60 days ago, that I would encourage you to go download, talking about insider threat. However, right, if we look about insider threats in general, and I'm going to ask that we pivot our thinking for a second. Bad actors who do bad things, right, typically, ultimately, an outsider more times than not, has become an insider, right, with some kind of abusive privilege or, commandeering privileges. So I would say the people who are that are have implemented Zero Trust or implementing it correctly. The thing about it is, right, it's not only you got the network access component, you're worried about your data pillar. Identity and access management is important, but identity verification is not a one and done. And I think this is that one thing, right, when we talk about where MFA becomes extremely powerful. And while it's not, obviously, it's not foolproof because it has, there's, you know, MFA has been demonstrated to be defeatable. It's better than the alternative. So I definitely, these points and questions, and I love the interaction with you all. And let's see here. It's not a good approach as well, because you need to rely upon your folks first and trust them. I did an interview, right, with an Australian outlet. I think it was last week, and we talked that exact thing. And it truly is this balancing act. There is this level of trust. I think that this is where security education, awareness training, you could take it to the next level if you want, and really kind of you're giving them more than just the prototypical hyper-focused on phishing and whatnot. Is you're really kind of helping them understand what the risks of doing anything out there, because most of them just, they don't know. They didn't have to deal with that. So a lot of great involvement here, interactivity. I really, truly appreciate everything.
And you can watch for more of these 2022 trends and priorities on cybersecurity, privacy, audit, and risk in a blog series we have coming up. So be sure to check that out. And thank you all for joining us today. Have a great day.